From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Afro-American and African Literature and Philosophy. Those are the topics this week on Soundings, the second in a series of conversations on subjects related to Black History Month, February 1987. My guests on this edition of Soundings are Bell Hooks, a literary critic from Yale University, and Kwasi Wiredu, a philosopher from the University of Ghana. Bell Hooks teaches writing and literature at Yale. She's the author of Ain't I a Woman? And Feminist Theory, From Margin to Center, in which she argues that the struggle to end racism and the struggle to end sexism are naturally intertwined. In both works, Bell Hooks also stresses the importance of the ties that bind the study of literature to the practical concerns of everyday life. Let me put it to you this way, Bell Hooks. A title of one of your books is Feminist Theory, From Margin to Center. How might that subtitle connect to this sort of real-world approach that you are describing, the real-world connection between literature and the way people live?
Well, that very title comes out of my own experience of living in a town that was racially segregated, and the idea of the margin comes from Black people living on the edges of towns, as Black people frequently did in the South. Lived on the edges of towns and went into the center. Right. And one of the things that I say in the introduction to this book is that Black people would go into the center and then come back to the margin, and that in some senses had an opportunity to see the whole picture, because they went into that center and they saw all the nuances of life there, and they came back to those margins. And I think this is one of the reasons Black women have so much to offer, both the production of feminist literary theory and the production of feminist theory. For example, there's a book by Carolina Maria de Jesus. This is a Brazilian Black woman who lived in the Brazilian ghettos, called Child of the Dark. And one of the things this book does is she's very, very poor. And what you see when you read this diary of her life is that even though she's very, very poor, and there are many days that her children can't eat, she has this tremendous desire to keep alive a sense of play and creativity in their life. And she chronicles in this diary some of the things that she does in order to do that. Games that she invents. I think that's the kind of statement about life in the margins that suggests to us that it has all of this negativity, but it also has does not, in fact, totally dehumanize people if they choose not to be dehumanized.
You're telling me then that literature really, for all of the sort of grandiose labels that we might apply to it when we talk of themes and meanings and all of that, you're really talking about the commonplace and the uses by literature of ordinary everyday human experience, and particularly here as it applies to what, race, class, gender? Are we on the right track?
Absolutely. To give you a concrete example, I frequently begin my classes by talking about the fact that Afro-American literature is a literature that comes out of the structure of oppression. And so when we look at the first Afro-American narratives, they are the slave narratives, prose narratives, and that we see certainly in those narratives, there has been historically a primacy of the Black male voice. I mean, Frederick Douglass's narrative, say, being a narrative that many, many people hear about. But part of what feminism has done, and I think feminism is really the key in terms of calling attention to the absence of this voice, the Black female voice, and then, and in so doing, also creating a climate wherein that voice can begin to be heard, where people can feel like people are listening. And one of the things that I just finished an essay that I recently gave at Amherst College about the fact that black women, I feel, haven't been silent. I mean, if you know the kind of feminist literary theory that, say, Gilbert and Gubar mm-hmm. have written, where they've talked about women moving from silence into speech. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've argue in my piece is that there are groups of women, I would say Jewish women, many Jewish women, and black women, who have never been silent. And if you enter our communities, are talking up a storm. But the question is, who's listening?
Right.
And I say that our struggle isn't so much to move from silence into speech, but to move into a speech, a discourse that can be heard.
Who are some of these voices that we might listen to in the 1980s? Bell Hooks, you might be self-serving and tell people to read your own books. These are critical, principally, rather than, well, there's a great controversy today over which is the critical and which is the creative. Let's avoid that whole sort of issue. But, you know, just in terms of novelists and poets, essayists for a third category, who should we be listening to? Who are they? What are they writing?
I think that it's important to read the theoretical mm-hmm. works, because they provide a framework for it wherein one can understand a lot of what is going on in the fictions. Mm-hmm. And I think in terms of the theoretical stuff, much which tries to integrate the creative and the theoretical, certainly works like my own work, Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism, Feminist Theory from Margin to Center, but also the works of people like Barbara Smith, Audre Lorde. Mm-hmm. A recent book I read that I was really excited by was Deborah White's book, Aren't I a Woman, which is a sort of history of the black female slave community. Certainly Jackie Jones' book, mm-hmm. Labor of Love, Labor of Sorrow.
Well, now let me stop you, Bell Hooks. These are not household names.
Right.
We might have a household name, for example, in somebody like Toni Morrison.
Right. Well, I was going to get on to that.
Okay.
Because first I wanted to say some of the books that provide a background, uh-huh. which are of course, one of the exciting things is that we would like to see books like these that people don't know the names come into the fore, because when we talk about writers, certainly I think, for me, one of the most exciting black women writers of today is Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. And I have to acknowledge my bias, because I wrote my dissertation on Toni Morrison. I'm absolutely excited by her writing style. Yeah.
But you would also include people like Alice Walker,
yes.
or Maya Angelou. Why are they worth reading? Let me be a little impertinent. What's the big deal?
I think that the big deal is the fact that even though they write about a specifically black female experience, it has incredible implications on a global and universal scale in terms of, for example, the struggle that, say, someone like Sula has mm-hmm. in Morrison's novel by that name to discover herself, to discover who she is. Or let's say an older black writer that influences Morrison, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which mm-hmm. I think prior to The Color Purple was one of the most widely read books. I mean, Janie's struggle to find herself and to get in touch with her sexuality has implications for women all over the world, mm-hmm. as well as I find that male students also feel a real strong identification with her longing to find out who she is. Mm-hmm. And I think that one besides, you know, the marketing and et cetera, that these books are exciting people because they address the kinds of issues that are really troubling to people right now in their lives.
Are you an optimist, Bell Hooks, as you look at American society and you assess what our literature and the problems, the challenges that we face with respect to gender and class and race? You sound optimistic, but tell me.
Well, you know, as soon as you said that, my mind flashed on another black woman writer who died at 35 of cancer, Lorraine Hansberry, black woman playwright who wrote Raisin in the
Raisin
Sun.
Raisin in the Sun, right.
And The Sign in Sidney Bernstein's Window. And it recalled to me someone asking her despair, uh-huh. about despair and whether she felt despair was a question in this world. I think that, like Lorraine Hansberry, I feel, how can one be aware and not feel a certain degree of despair? Uh-huh. But at the same time that we feel this despair, we stand as testimony ourselves to the possibility of new horizons and of change. And I think Hansberry wrote about this a great deal in her essays. And I tend to feel always caught between both the despair that I feel in terms of mass and collective change, mm-hmm. and the excitement that I feel within my own, you know, life in terms of thinking about moving from Hopkinsville, Kentucky to writing two books and to all those different kinds of things that say,
that's right,
look, change is possible in people's mm-hmm. lives. And I think what there's hope on that kind of individual level, and I think the struggle is to try to extend that out on a more general and mass level mm-hmm. so that we can feel that hope that doesn't say, well, gee, we've got 100 fallen and we've got one person who's passed through, and we'd like to make that passing through passage large enough mm-hmm. to encompass more people.
Bell Hooks, we're talking about literature and race and class and gender. You are an English professor at Yale University. Would you say that black women writers today are secondary to the male black writers that we're aware of in our society? How would you characterize that connection?
Well, I think now we move on to a less optimistic picture mm-hmm. in the sense that I think racism has always had a tremendous impact on how black literature is seen, and that unfortunately there's been a tendency to create a kind of oppositional sense of black women's writing and black men's writing, so that, you know, there was a time when the focus was Richard Wright, Native Son, right. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, and now a lot of people feel like, well, the focus has shifted to Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, and no one is reading Ishmael Reed, James McPherson, Al Young, all kinds of black male writers. And I think that this is a false sense of opposition, and that we have to repudiate it. We have to place it within the advertising world, where clearly we know that white women and privileged white women are large book buyers mm-hmm. in our culture. And it's not surprising that as feminism has moved on, fiction by females and fiction by black females is receiving a great deal of attention. I think we're incorrect to see that in an oppositional way. It's only logical in this struggle for female voice mm-hmm. that women are going to be interested in hearing from women. And I don't know how long that's going to last, but
yeah.
I don't think it's something that should lead to this sense of opposition between the black male writer. I like to think that my students will want to go on to read black male writers as well.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I try to bring that into our discussion so that they would feel that excitement about black male writing.
So you observe what? A series of continuities as much as a series of tensions in these relationships. Let's conclude our conversation. Bell Hooks, you come to the Humanities Center as a visitor from Yale University. How would you tell me about your goals as a feminist critic, as a black feminist critic? Are they highfalutin and grandiose and academic, or are they sort of down to earth? Where do they fall?
Well, I consider them down to earth and sometimes rather funky in a way. I mean, my goals right now, which I think they change over time, and I think that right now a lot of my work and a lot of my interest is in what I call self-recovery, mm-hmm. and that places it on a very real level in people's lives. That is to say that I'm interested in people who feel wounded, mm. whether they feel wounded by racism, sexism, class oppression, or what have you, getting in touch with those wounds and how they can heal those wounds. And I like to think that both literature and theory it can be agents in that healing process. Certainly for me as a naive young girl who went to Stanford as an undergraduate and started Ain't I a Woman There, mm-hmm. that book was in part my own struggle to find out who am I as a black woman and what is my history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of sense of empowerment, which is a word that is used a lot lately in feminist circles, it makes me feel like this is a wonderful reason to write, a wonderful reason to do theoretical and critical mm-hmm. work.
So just as a footnote to that, Bell Hooks, you would certainly endorse the whole enterprise of autobiography. I'm thinking of critics such as James Olney and John Socorro, and then the writers themselves.
Absolutely. I just read a tremendous autobiographical work called Lemon Swamp about a black family in Charleston, mm-hmm. and it's exciting. I mean, these kinds of work are, I think, begin a groundwork where we can move beyond them into more exciting and experimental fictions.
Bell Hooks teaches writing and literature at Yale University. She's the author of Ain't I a Woman? And Feminist Theory, From Margin to Center. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on topics related to Black History Month continues now with a conversation with Kwasi Wiredu, a native of Ghana and scholar of African philosophy. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Kwasi Wiredu worked on his forthcoming book entitled God, Mind, and Destiny in African Philosophy. According to Kwasi Wiredu, African philosophy is best understood in the light of several overarching philosophical tensions, including those among the spiritual and the material, the mystical and the empirical, the natural and the supernatural. The focus of Kwasi Wiredu's work is his native tribe of the Akans, which comprises two-thirds of Ghana's population of 14 million people.
Talk to me then concretely and specifically about the differentiation between spirit and matter in the constructs of the Akans.
Yes, well, now here, the important point is this, that the distinction between the spiritual and the material mm-hmm. does not exist in Akan thought. There is a distinction of degree between various entities in terms of the degree to which they are subject to the constraints of space and time. Mm-hmm. For example, our ancestors are supposed to be in constant touch with the living, mm-hmm. and they can punish the living if they deviate from the morality of the society.
Now, this is one of the fundamental beliefs in the Akans tribe.
Yes. Right. Now, a person may be anywhere, mm-hmm. and if he does things that are obnoxious to the community and to the, you know, and to the morality of the mm-hmm. society,
much less to the ancestors.
Yes, then he can be punished.
Right,
he can be punished by, say, being afflicted with illness.
Tell me about another of these wonderful large words in the project title that you are pursuing here, and that is the word destiny. How does the concept of destiny work itself into and through African philosophy? Again, with particular reference to the Akans tribe.
Well, here we have interesting similarities and some dissimilarities. Mm-hmm. The belief among the Akans is that every person has a destiny that's given to him mm-hmm. by God.
Now, this is in another existence, coming into this world? How does that work?
Not quite in another existence, though. Well, the story is this, that before any person comes into this world, mm-hmm. God gives an entity which is the life-giving entity. But anyway, this entity, which in our language is called the Okra, mm-hmm. takes its destiny from God, and it comes to this world to work out this destiny. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, you might say that the theory is one of predestination, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which you are familiar with in Christianity. In this respect, the idea seems to be that some people are given a good okra, mm-hmm. and some are given a bad soul. But even though one is supposed to have one's destiny, generally, one is supposed to have one's destiny from God, and even though there are explicit assertions to the effect that what God gives, what the destiny that God gives, cannot be changed, nevertheless, there are procedures for reversing a bad destiny. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a rather specific question. We're talking about these three very large terms, God, mind, and destiny in Western philosophy. How does the element of free agency or choice enter into this mixture of God and destiny that you have been outlining? Do you think of yourself, for example, as a free agent set against what you have described as the characteristics that you have inherited that God has given you?
Yes, the concept of free will mm-hmm. does not quite have an equivalent in our thought, but we have the concept of a responsible agent.
What do you make of a word such as chance, that which is random and unpredictable? Is that consistent with any or all of these concepts that you are outlining for me?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The concept of chance is rendered in our language mm-hmm. by a word which is made from two smaller words. The word is akwanshia, and akwan means way or road, mm-hmm. and here means meet. And chance is a meeting of ways. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that a chance is a meeting of various causal ways, which are not predictable ahead mm-hmm. ahead of the situation.
You remind right. me of a little poem by our American poet Robert Frost called The Way or the Road Not Taken. All of the various possibilities that present themselves to one in one's life. So there is a similarity there.
Yes, uh-huh. yes. Okay, so there is a concept of chance.
Right.
Although in our thought, there is a strong belief in universal causation, and indeed in universal intelligibility.
All right, now, and God would be what, right at the beginning, or the first cause there in all of that causation? Am I right? Do I have that right?
Well, yes. Well, God is supposed to have introduced order mm-hmm. into the world, you mm-hmm. know, into the world as we know it. So all the processes and so on are due to the kind of order that God gave unto the world.
And how does chance fit into this orderliness?
Well, chance fits in that although all events have causes, mm-hmm. these lines of causation can intersect at various points.
And create new causations.
Which are not predictable.
Uh-huh.
That's how you get chance.
Well, that's somehow satisfying and frustrating at the same time. All right, now in this mixture of God and society and forces, what you term forces, our topic is African philosophy, Kwasi Wiredu. When something bad happens, we have a social calamity or a natural catastrophe, who gets the blame? God or man or these forces that you have been describing? How do you figure those threads out?
Well, if it is an extraordinary calamity, then people will begin to suspect that perhaps some forces mm-hmm. have been at work.
For example,
some,
famine.
Some non-human forces uh-huh. have been at work.
If you talk of famine, where do you pass the blame? Where does the buck stop?
Well, people will not immediately try to find extra-human causes. Hmm. I mean, if the rains don't come, mm-hmm. and you have bad harvests and so on, well, that is known to be one of the things that can happen mm-hmm. through the ordinary causes and effects of this world.
And it's enough to leave it at that.
So it can be left at that.
I see.
But if it is a terrible, terrible famine, that does not appear to yield to any ordinary explanations, mm-hmm. then people will suspect
that God has a hand.
Perhaps, not necessarily God, uh-huh. but perhaps the society has done something uh-huh. very wrong against uh-huh. some non-human forces. Mm-hmm. And so they'll begin to think of ways of coming to terms with these forces.
Mm-hmm. Kwasi Wiredu, let's conclude our conversation. You are a scholar from Ghana. You come to the Humanities Center working on a project which you have called God, Mind, and Destiny in African Philosophy. You live your life, as it were, at a rather abstract or theoretical level, and yet the newspapers every day come to us with headlines about terrible, pressing, social, practical problems in the nations of Africa, in the Third World. Is that the sort of thing that you do as a philosopher? Does it do those problems enter into your work?
Well, they do enter into my consciousness because I'm very, very conscious of these problems. Mm-hmm. And I do hope that my studies can have a beneficial impact on these problems. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I have this hope is this, that we have been subject to foreign influences that have come to us, not through our own choice, but through a kind of imposition, mm-hmm. that's through colonialism.
Yeah.
Now, I think that that is a very hard fit for any culture. When the culture is dominated by another culture, by force, through force, and its life, its intellectual life, and even cultural life, is affected through this kind of causation, then you have confusions which can bring all sorts of dangers to the society.
Not only philosophical, but practical.
Practical dangers.
Yes.
At the moment, we see a lot of confusion in African life because our very thought processes have been affected very seriously
mm-hmm.
by foreign ways of looking at the world, which we have not been able to synthesize.
Mm-hmm. How do you propose, for example, to offset these forces, or even turn them back to say, stop, enough is enough, we need to think in our own fashion? Is that possible in an international situation when you have so many cross currents that are irreversible?
Yes, indeed. Well, so the first thing is to have an accurate knowledge mm-hmm. of our own ways of thought.
I see.
Right? And to distinguish between those and the ways of thought that we have learned
mm-hmm.
from abroad, and then to make an appraisal. No doubt we will have to take things from abroad. But when you take something from abroad as a result of a conscious reflection,
mm-hmm.
then that is all right.
That's preferable too.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But at the moment, we have all sorts of confusions which penetrate all levels of life, because we are now operating with a confused jumble of thought elements. So the first thing is to become aware of exactly what we have and what we have taken from abroad, and then to make a synthesis.
Kwasi Wiredu is a native of Ghana and a student of African philosophy. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Kwasi Wiredu worked on his forthcoming book, entitled God, Mind, and Destiny in African Philosophy. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Afro-American and African Literature and Philosophy, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, Soundings on Black History Month will continue. The topics will be social and economic history in the 19th century American South. My guests will include scholars from Middlebury College, the American University, and Purdue University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for the second in a series of programs on topics related to Black History Month, February 1987. Wayne's guests this week are Bell Hooks, a literary critic from Yale University, and Kwasi Wiredu, a philosopher from the University of Ghana. Afro-American Literature and African Philosophy, the topics this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station.